Jay Bardeen versus Diane M. Peterson et al. I just want to confirm with counsel that you will not be splitting your time. We will only have Mr. Mahoney and Mr. Moore arguing. Is that correct?
Correct on my part.
That's okay. Correct, Judge. If there's arguments to be made on the motion to strike, those are going to be handled by my co-counsel, Gary Strutman, but I'll be handling the oral argument on the appeal.
Okay. Will you be splitting your time then?
No. He'll handle the motion. I'll handle the appeal.
Okay. So today is Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for initial arguments. And then counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your arguments. After that, counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you want to use that time. This proceeding is being recorded, I should say. No other recordings are allowed or permitted, either audio or video recordings. If we do run into any issues at all with respect to the technology, we will certainly make accommodations for whatever, you know, whatever comes up. We have done that in the past, for better, for worse. But we do appreciate you joining us via zoom.gov. We wish we could be meeting with all of you in person, but obviously with the pandemic, we cannot do that. And per Chief Justice orders, we are meeting virtually at this time. So with that, we will go ahead and proceed. Counsel for appellant, you please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
It please the court. My name is Michael Mahoney. I represent the appellants, Diana M. Peterson and DP Financial Services, Inc. We are here asking this court to start with the remedy that we are seeking. We're asking this court to reverse the district court's denial of the motion for directed verdict, or JMOL, both at the time of the conclusion of the case in chief by Mr. Bardeen and after the trial was completed. We are also asking the court to reverse the district court's decision to deny the motion for a new trial. We are asking for a remand with instructions that the appellants may proceed with their case, which was for breach of contract, breach of fiduciary duty, unjust enrichment, but with instructions specifically focusing on the matters that we raised in the brief. Those matters relate to the instructions with respect to experts. That is, we submit that the court erred as a matter of law, and that it's a de novo review for the court to allow testimony by persons who were listed as fact witnesses, when in fact, when they appeared, they gave testimony as experts. We objected to the testimony, but the court denied our objection. So on a remand, we're asking that it be clear that they may not appear and give expert testimony. We're also asking and suggesting to this court that the court has an opportunity to clarify the rules with respect to the United Prairie decision on award of attorney's fees and the instructions. The instructions in this case, which were given to the jury in a bifurcated manner, consisted of 161 words that roughly summarized our, all right, jury, you have the facts, now you go figure out what the award of attorney's fees are. So with that, I'll go back to the beginning of the case, which is at the conclusion of Mr.
Mahoney, if I may.
Yes, Judge Jensen, yes.
I know you're probably getting to this later, but since you brought up the attorney's fees award, I was looking at that in more detail. And I understand you propose that the district judge give a lot more detail in the jury instructions for dealing with attorney's fees. But is it part of the challenge here that we have a jury deciding attorney's fees, which can be complicated? Normally that would be the district judge, right? But then I get back to, your client ask to have that decided by a jury? So isn't that just inherent that a jury's gonna be a little more challenged perhaps? Attorney's fees.
I think I've got an echo there. Was there another question? No, I think I'll try to answer the question as I understand it. My client did move for jury determination under United Prairie, and the focus of that was specifically the purchase of practice agreement and words in the purchase of practice agreement, a contract that provided for contractual attorney's fees to the prevailing party. So we submit, as a matter of law, it was error for the court to submit the attorney's fees under a completely different theory. But then going to your point, Judge Jessen, about, well, isn't it inherent that a jury is going to have some difficulty determining what the attorney's fees should be? We submit it doesn't have to be that way. There were a lot of comments after the United Prairie decision, and that arguments were made that that's going to be too difficult for a jury to follow. And we submit that it's an opportunity for this court to lay out three basic rules. First, the Hensley and Milner cases lay out the proposition for the determination of reasonable attorney's fees. Second, there's elements of the attorney's fees which trial judges are used to analyzing and determining the reasonable value of the attorney's fees. Such elements include the matter of success, the degree of success, the reasonableness. And we submit here, it was unreasonable as a matter of law for a jury to arrive at a conclusion of $64,717 when the maximum amount that could have been awarded, we think it was error anyway, was $87,500. That's 75%. I don't know if I answered your question, Judge, but.
No, that was helpful, Mr. Mahoney. Can I ask one other attorney's fees question? I'll let you get back to the beginning of your argument, if I may. But shouldn't we look at what was asked for the jury on attorney's fees, which is, I understand it, and you'll know this better than I do, kind of over $150,000 for the Raymond James fees and what, $88,000 for fees for respondent. And the jury came back with $64,000, which does, at least looking at those numbers, gives a sense they were being careful. They weren't just blindly awarding them. Shouldn't we take that into consideration?
No, I don't believe they could possibly have been careful, because the instructions, as I pointed out, were 161 words, basically said, you go figure it out. Then they were given something like 369 pages of documents that all connected to elements that had no basis for recovery under a prevailing party theory. The theory under which it went to the jury for attorney's fees was uniquely indemnification. There was no claim for indemnification made in this case. Indemnification and third-party beneficiary did not come up until the court, the district court, deus ex machina, dropped those elements in at the time that we're proceeding to the jury. So the answer is the jury had no basis to make a determination that there was a prevailing party or contractual basis for awarding attorney's fees. It's indemnification. And as you all know, indemnification is a unique theory that requires, among other things, there has to be notice providing for indemnification. No notice was given. No pleading was given. It was an ambush. So I don't know if I answered your question. If you have any other question, I'll answer it. But I'd like to move on, if I may.
Mr. Mahoney, actually, if I may stop you there, you actually touched on something that I wanted to ask about. You talked about ambush there, and in your brief, you go through why you believe that appellants were ambushed by the expert opinions by several people who were listed as fact witnesses. But those were people who were actually involved in the investigation. So it appears that at a minimum on its face that they were fact witnesses, but you list some of the testimony. And when I looked at the testimony, I had a hard time seeing anything that really looked like what could be considered expert testimony, particularly with respect to federal regulations. They primarily were focusing on what their own internal investigation uncovered and came up with. I didn't really see anything in terms of legal opinions or legal analysis or federal statutes and guidelines. It seemed to be more focused on this is what happened. So why is it, why is it expert legal expert opinion versus fact opinion?
The analysis of that question is to divide up the kinds of testimony that they gave. I believe it's proper for a fact witness to testify that we came to the premises, we did this kind of examination, and these are the facts that we found. Facts like there's a document that was in a file, there was an email that was submitted. But for all of those witnesses, their testimony, we pointed it out in the brief, they testified that the conduct that they identified was a breach and violation of both Raymond James policies and a testimony that it violated various FINRA. FINRA is the Financial Industry National Association, and that's the replacement of the NASD. They were allowed to testify that this conduct violated various rules and regulations, and we submit that was prejudicial because for two reasons. One, it allowed these five witnesses to basically present a story that we had no basis to determine those expertise testimony would be presented. If we had had that, because they're not listed as experts, we would have been able to submit rebuttal witnesses. So I believe that their testimony colored all of the trial with respect to Diana Peterson. If I may,
but why isn't that test? Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. Judge Warkey, did you have a comment?
Well, I want to take him in another direction. Mr. Mahoney, we're just not going to let you decide the order of your argument. So I have an argument I wanted to go on if you're done, Judge Reyes. All right, here's what I want you to focus on. This is what I think is really intriguing. And it has to do with the independent contractor agreement because, you know, I'm with you. It's pretty clear. It says it expires 6 months from the date of signing. And then we have some conduct that the jury inferred as being the reasonable, I don't want to say renegotiation, but continuing to operate under that independent contractor agreement, but with different terms. I guess that's the way I would say your client's getting a different commission. What's your strongest evidence that you have that she did not continue during that time period in April until her termination in November 2015, that she wasn't doing the same stuff that the ICA initially provided for?
Three points, Judge Warkey. First, the subsequent purchase of practice agreement has an express merger clause that excludes any possibility that any prior agreement exists. So if you look at paragraph 15 of the purchase of practice agreement, it ended. And those terms are clear and unambiguous. There's no opportunity to go back to the independent contractor agreement. But even if you look at the independent contractor agreement by its express terms, it provided that it ended on April 4th of 2014. It could be renegotiated. The word renegotiation means parties have to participate. At the close of the case in chief, Ms. Peterson had not testified. So there could not be any testimony with respect to the renegotiation. Furthermore, the contract by its express term could only be extended an additional year. So even if they negotiated an extension, it ended April of 15, which is 6 months before the events that give rise to the damages. Lastly, the independent contractor agreement expressly provided for payments of a different commission that was identified by the expert, by Ms. Peterson, and by Mr. Bardeen. The independent contractor agreement had a 90% payout. The purchase of practice agreement negotiated an entirely different arrangement, and Schedule B delineates a 80% payout. So as a matter of law, there's no possibility that independent contractor agreement could have existed when they negotiated a new purchase of practice agreement. There's no evidence of conduct that's consistent with extending it.
So Mr. Mahoney, that last point is where I'm not sure. It seems like the conduct was consistent with the parties continuing because she continued to do the work the same as before. The only difference appears to be the 80% versus 90%. And it doesn't appear that she objected to it. So it seems like her conduct and the conduct of all the parties indicated that they assumed that agreement was in fact going to remain in place, and that's permissible, right?
No. The argument that you're focusing on, Judge Reyes, is whether or not the parties can amend a contract by conduct, because the express terms of the contract bind the court. The court is required to take the words of the contract as they are written, not write a new contract. Those words ended the contract. There are cases, well-established cases, that in unusual circumstances, parties can amend a contract by their conduct. But when the contract expressly provides the conditions under which the contract may be continued, the court's bound to follow those party negotiated terms. It ended.
Mr. Mahoney, I'm gonna go back and look at the PPA, because what I'm hearing you saying is that October 25, 2013, they executed the ICA, but then in November of that very same year, from October to November, they execute the PPA, and you're saying that that just wiped out the prior agreement?
Yes.
My question is this, but I will look at it. Is there a specific terminology in the purchase of practice agreement, the PPA, that says, you know, that's it, this is what we're operating under now, and what we signed the month before is out?
Yes, but Judge Reyes, I don't know if I answered your question, but I'll take
it. I'm sorry if I leaped in and it wasn't.
Judge Werke, I'll go to answer your question, then I'll go backwards and see if I need to add anything. The express question was their express words, and paragraph 15 of the purchase of practice agreement, which is page 4 of 6, reads, and I'll just read the first few words. This agreement shall supersede any and all other oral or written agreements prior to the date of execution of this agreement. My 15 minutes is up. Judge Werke.
That answers my question. Thank you.
And I believe Judge Jessen has a question.
So just one final question, Mr. Mahoney. I want to make sure I understand your position on the good faith and fair dealing claim. So I understand, but correct me if I'm wrong, that you're saying, look, you can't maintain that claim without valid contracts. And that goes back to the, was the FAA contract valid because it wasn't signed by Raymond James, or the ICA contract because it ended? So my question is this, well, I want to make sure I understand that correctly. My question is, if this court were to say those contracts were valid, or the jury was appropriate in its decisions on that, would that mean we do not need to reach the good faith and fair dealing claim because those are valid contracts?
I understand the question. I think you do. If the contracts, ICA and FAA agreement, exist, then we submit that the independent, separate, implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing is simply another form of breach. And as the cases we cited, this is a doubling up of the recovery. There was $87,500 that was awarded for the breach of both of the written contracts, and $87,500 that was awarded for the breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And no reported case has ever permitted that in Minnesota or anywhere else to allow for that, because it's simply another form of breach of contract.
So, Judge Reyes, may I ask one follow-up question on that?
Yes, please.
So I would understand that if the special verdict form had broken out for each claim, the good faith and fair dealing. But here we have an award for good faith and fair dealing, but we also have one contract that they said wasn't breached. So why wouldn't, because I understand what you're saying, you don't do that, it's not double dipping. But why wasn't it appropriate to assume the jury was awarding that for the contract, the PPP, I think, or PPA, that wasn't breached?
Well, because that's logically inconsistent. Something cannot be and not be at the same time. The implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing is a breach of contract. So when the jury determined there was no breach of the PPA, there cannot be a breach of any form, whether it's a written and it's express or an implied. And that's the difficulty with this. And the district court, again, dropped in an analysis that we submit is an absurd reading of the relationship between the implied covenant of good faith and a contract which the jury found was not breached. that, I think I'm, my time is up. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mahoney. We will now turn to respondents. And for respondents, I just want to be clear, Mr. Moore, you had mentioned that your colleague was going to talk about the motion to strike. Did you want to reserve a certain amount of time for your co-counsel to speak on the motion to strike, or?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I believe I've created some confusion. I thought that the court might specifically address that motion before we got to these arguments. So if we're just making our arguments, then no, I'll just be doing the talking.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Yep, not a problem at all. Just wanted to make sure we're all on the same page. So you will have 15 minutes then for your arguments, and you may proceed. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
May it please the court. I am Patrick Moore. I, along with my co-counsel, Gary Strootman, represent the respondent, Ronald J. Bardeen, in today's appearance. Your Honor, we would like to discuss and point out some irregularities of this case during the trial. There were a lot of irregularities, and it was a very unusual civil case for both Mr. Strootman and I in our experience. We believe that these irregularities helped shape the decisions made by the trial court and helped shape the opinion or the verdict rendered by the jury. The first irregularity that we would like to point out, Judge, is the expert witnesses used by the appellants. It seemed very irregular that both opinions from a CPA opining about damages and a financial advisor opining about fiduciary duties were rendered on the same date. Both opinions had similar formatting.
What does this have to do with the issues that raised in by the appellant's brief? And your client was successful in this appeal. You didn't raise a notice of related appeal, what we used to call a cross appeal. I'm just hoping that quickly you kind of explain, because I was mystified reading your brief. I'm like, what does this have to do with anything?
Okay, thank you, Judge. I'm just pointing out that these were oddities that did help shape the opinions. And we believe that these are part of the story that we're here to tell. But if you'd like me to move on to the issues, Judge, I will. Your Honor, I would like to first address the judgments as a matter of law. Rule 50. Your Honor, the judgment as a matter of law motion was made at the end of our case in chief and again at the conclusion of trial. Rule 50 states that if there is no legally sufficient evidentiary basis for a reasonable jury to decide for that party on that issue, we believe that the record shows and speaks for itself that there was plenty of legally sufficient evidence for the jury to decide based on the record and the evidence put forth at trial. The denial of the motion for the new trial, Your Honor, Rule 59. We believe that the standard of review for this is a clear abuse of discretion, not de novo, as argued by the appellants. The court, in its thoughtful opinion, when it denied the new trial, relied a lot on the decision in Dostal. The Dostal court said, the decision to grant a new trial generally lies within the sound discretion of the district court and will not be disturbed absent a clear abuse of that discretion.
So if I may, Mr. Moore.
Yes, please.
I understand the abuse of discretion standard overall, but if there are legal issues that the district court decided, you know, in moving forward with the trial, those we would review de novo, correct? And my second part of that question, isn't the question of whether the FAA contract is valid given that it wasn't signed by Raymond James, isn't that a legal question that we would review de novo, just as one example?
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. And maybe I should just get right to the point on the FAA agreement and the ICA agreement. That might be the best use of my time here. On the ICA agreement, as has been pointed out earlier in this argument, the express terms say that it expires in 6 months. However, it is our position that the parties continued to abide by the terms of the agreement. we do not agree that the PPA or the purchase or practice agreement replaced or in any way terminated the ICA. We don't believe that's true. Evidence.
Mr. Moore, if I may, could you point the court to what you think is the best case that says, look, parties can by their conduct not just extend, but extend and alter the terms of a contract? Because isn't that what happened here? I mean, you're saying it was extended, but it was also changed because it went from 90 to 80%. So if you just let us know what you think is best.
Judge, I would have to rely on my brief. I don't have a case loaded up for me today on the contract law. I'm sorry. What I would say is that the evidence showed that our client, Ronald J. Bardeen, when he terminated the four agreements, also in writing terminated the ICA and the FA, showing that in his opinion, those agreements were still valid agreements. So it shows the intent of the parties. At no time did he or the appellants discuss or agree that those agreements were terminated. The checks and the money, it kept flowing the same as the agreements contemplated. So we believe that it was the intention of the parties that those agreements were in effect right up until he terminated them. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I have a question along those same lines, Mr. Moore. Why isn't that paragraph 15 of the PPA, why did that not supersede the ICA? Because when I look at paragraph 15, it says, quote, "This agreement shall supersede any and all other oral or written agreements prior to the date of execution of this agreement, which may have been entered into between the parties hereto." Why didn't that supersede the ICA?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the parties paid attention to the language of the agreements. I believe that they signed them and then they just continued to move forward in their business. They
did But Mr. Moore, I mean, the parties have to pay attention to the agreements. If you're going to sign a document, if you're going to sign an agreement, you need to know what those terms are. You need to know what you're signing and you need to abide by those terms. And if you disagree with any term or provision, that the time to argue that it is at the time of negotiation before you sign it, not after saying, well, no, the parties just continued doing business as usual, regardless of what the agreement says.
Understood, Judge. We're dealing with two non-lawyer parties. But
these are sophisticated business people.
I agree, Judge. So what I would say, Judge, is that the PPA taken as a whole with all four agreements shows the intention of the parties. The FA agreement, if we can talk about that one, that was signed by both parties. The fact that it was unsigned by Raymond James is irrelevant. Raymond James was not a party to the trial court action. And no one was trying to enforce the FA against Raymond James. Raymond James, as we've discussed, had three executives testify during the trial court. None of them indicated that the FA agreement was not a valid contract or that Raymond James was not did not recognize it. And by the fact that Diana Peterson was a Raymond James financial advisor working under the branch of Raymond James shows that Raymond James at some point did accept the FA, whether or not we had a signed copy and evidence or not. So I believe the FA was very much a valid signed contract. The ICA, we believe the parties went by the terms, they got paid by the terms. It was essential to the appellant's compensation. And I believe that if the parties had believed that that agreement was terminated, they would have stopped making the commission payments therein. So, Your Honor, let's move on.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Okay, I need to go back to this. You have the independent contractor agreement. Terms of that, they're clear. 6 months extended for at most a year, I think, if I'm repeating Mr. Mahoney correctly on that. So then, as I indicated before, you had October 25 and then November 4, the PPA was executed. The PPA says, that's it, this is the new contract. So the entire argument is any breach stemming from the 2015 November termination would legally be impossible. And you're saying, well, forget what these contracts actually say. They were acting on their own. I'm starting to be disturbed by that. So here's my question. I do have a question. Was that theory presented to the trial court, or is, I mean, it's well briefed, and I understand Mr. Mahoney's argument, but was that something that the trial court made a ruling on because this went to a jury? I just need to know how that came up in the district court.
Your Honor, there was evidence at trial about the party's conduct under the agreements. There was evidence of my client's termination of the agreement.
Well, evidence, but was there argument presented that when the PPA was executed, that that nullified, if you will, the ICA?
Yes, I believe if you look at our response to the motion for the new trial and our briefs in that motion hearing, that we did argue those points. Yes, Judge. And I would rely on my briefs therein. So let's move on to the executives as fact witnesses. We believe that the Raymond James witnesses were noticed first in our Rule 26 disclosures dated May 2017. They were again noticed on the witness list. These witnesses testified in the FINRA arbitration outside of this matter, but dealing with the same facts and circumstances between the appellants and Raymond James Financial Services. These witnesses' testimony in that action occurred 2 months before trial. When we got to trial, there was no classic trial by ambush. These witnesses had been noticed, re-noticed, and they'd even testified in a similar matter. We believe that the appellants were not prejudiced with the testimony of these witnesses. They did testify as fact witnesses, and they were well noticed. They did not depose them, although they had opportunities to depose them, and they did conduct depositions. They did not make a motion in limine with regard to this testimony, although they did make motions in limine. We believe that the attorney fees and costs were fairly submitted to the jury. As the court has said, this was at the request of the appellants that this go to the jury. We felt like it was an unusual request, but the trial court did rule on that motion and submitted this to the jury. We believe that the attorney fees and costs were properly submitted. We believe that the FA agreement, under its very terms, under section 12E, does allow for attorney fees and costs. We believe that those were properly thought out by the jury and properly awarded. A separate hearing was conducted on the matter, and the jury, both parties were present and had an opportunity to address the jury. We believe that there's the motion for a new trial over the jury instructions was properly denied. The standard review on that was set forth in 2002 by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Hilgas versus Cargill. The Supreme Court tells us the district court has broad discretion in determining jury instructions, and we will not reverse in the absence of the abuse of that discretion. There was a charging conference held. Everyone was present. It was a transparent process, and all parties were allowed to submit their proposed jury instructions. Neither party got everything they wanted, but every party got a say. Your Honors, we believe that the trial court did a fair and partial job of allowing both parties to submit their evidence and present their case to the jury. We believe that there was no abuse of discretion. We believe that the awards were properly determined under the four contracts. We appreciate your time in hearing our case today. Unless there's questions, I have no further argument. Thank you.
Looks like there are no further questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Moore. Mr. Mahoney, we'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. Mahoney, you're on mute. If you can unmute. There you go.
I thought I had. I'd like to start with the last argument, which is the argument that the attorney's fees issue was properly submitted. You will all recall, judges, that there were significant arguments about prevailing party. And we had submissions that we believe that the appellant was a prevailing party, but the court spent a lot of time reaching the conclusion that the respondent was the prevailing party. The reason for that, the sole reason for that, related to the purchase of practice agreement's language about the recovery of attorney's fees by the prevailing party. That's the basis under which the United Prairie motion was made. That's the basis upon which the trial court said we're going to submit attorney's fees to the jury. And then they not only changed the goalpost, the court changed the stadium. Said, no, we're not going to submit claims for attorney's fees under the purchase of practice agreement because there's no recovery under it. We're going to have an entirely new, never before discussed, never before presented argument that they're entitled to indemnification. And we, of course, objected because that's a complete change of the theory, and that is a classic ambush. So the submission of attorney's fees under a completely different theory, having nothing to do with who the prevailing party was, but a claim for indemnification, which requires as a matter of law that there's notice being made to submit for indemnification. Back to the opening of the argument, there was an argument that the parties did not agree in any manner with respect to the independent contractor agreement. They acted in a manner to continue it. That's categorically incorrect. They agreed specifically and in writing and did what business people should do. They had a written agreement expressly stated, we are abandoning any other prior agreements. They are no longer of any value whatsoever. And that's in paragraph 15 of the purchase practice agreement.
And but Mr. Mahoney, I mean, the reality is that business people may enter into an agreement, but the law does recognize that we can look at conduct of the parties. And even if you look at the written communications between the parties, you have the termination letters that were sent out for the FA, for the sublease, and for the independent contractor agreement dated October 27th of 2015, which clearly and expressly acknowledges that the parties had been operating under the ICA and the FA. But that those agreements were no longer effective as of that day, roughly 2 years later. So that seems to be pretty strong evidence that the parties, in fact, were operating under the assumption that it was going to continue. And based on that conduct, we've got a jury trial here. And I mean, we give great deference to the jury trial's findings and determinations. So why would we overturn it? Basically, what you're really asking us to do is overturn the jury verdict. And that's a pretty high hurdle.
In this case, I don't think it is at all. You have a unique...
Before you answer that question, I need to inject something that has to do with the same thing. So after I asked respondent counsel, about the independent contractor agreement, I went and he directed me back to the court's order for a new trial denying new trial. So I've got that in front of me now. So I've got some split screen going on. And I'm reading in that order at trial, I'm quoting now, and despite objections by defendants, the court also allowed testimony regarding the independent contractor agreement, which had previously expired based on its express terms. That's what you're arguing, aren't you?
Yes, the court found that. I mean, I'm absolutely arguing it, and it expired by its express terms. It did not continue. And then Judge Reyes raised the question, well, isn't it true that a party can uniquely submit a piece of paper, one-sided piece of paper, saying I'm terminating the agreement, that because I want to terminate the agreement, and that unique event establishes that the independent contractor agreement continued, even though the parties did three things. They had an express contract, written contract, signed by both of them that said it does not exist anymore. And none, zero, nada, none of the payments are consistent with the independent contractor agreement. They are only consistent with the purchase of practice agreement, which replaced the independent contractor agreement. So doesn't
that harbor against your argument then? If the PPA did in fact replace it, and the PPA said 80% commission, and then the parties kept on moving forward with that 80%, why doesn't that indicate that the parties are still continuing under an agreement?
There's two agreements.
Right.
Independent contractor agreement, which is sort of their starting arrangement. We are going to try to get together to do something. We intend to make a better and more complete agreement. They did make a better and more complete agreement, and now they're operating under that agreement. And there's a massive number of cases that provide that partners, business partners, people who can read agreements that negotiate a new agreement with express terms such as a merger clause are bound by it. And then their conduct is not consistent with following the independent contractor agreement. It's quite different. And there's a significant reduction in the payments. The independent contractor agreement had a 90% payout. Now they negotiate a new deal and go to an 80% payout. So I don't think there's any case, reported case anywhere, that would hold that the parties can act inconsistently with their written agreement and do a completely different deal.
Okay, Mr. Mahoney, you're out of time, but it looks like Judge Jessen has a question.
Thank you, Judge Rice. Just one question, and I'm trying to remember reading through the transcript, and maybe you can help me with this. Did your client or someone else testify that, after the PPA was signed in that November, none of the other contracts, continued? It replaced them all. I mean, was there that testimony at trial? Because I don't recall seeing it, but I'm sure you know this better than me.
I don't recall any testimony by my client, certainly, that continued. I recall that there was other testimony, but it focused, like the expert focused on the 80% payout. I believe the expert's report and his testimony uniquely focused on the purchase of practice agreement. There is no damage claim or causation related to the independent contractor agreement.
And my question is a little different, if I may. My question is, was there testimony to what you're saying now is that the PPA basically extinguished, kind of by its terms, the other agreements?
I don't recall. I couldn't point to something in the transcript. I don't believe that occurred. I don't believe that exchange occurred, and I don't believe that testimony occurred, if I understand the question right.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mahoney. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefing. We will issue an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. In the meantime, please stay safe and stay warm as well. Thank you both.
Both worth doing.